You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Galaxy Gear, Lunch with Tony Hadley, and Celebrity MasterChef Reviewed.
Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Parish Council, your podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw. Don't go sharing your emotions. Lay all your love on Terence Dackham.
Ooh, hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
That Scottish woman, she's gone missing again.
Yeah, I noticed that. Where is she this time?
I don't know. I like her. It's a shame. Here's the thing. Yeah. No, really, here is the thing. I imagine that when you're going out and about dining with the rich and famous, as you have been this week, as we're going to learn later, I'm sure you're a big tipper. However, the whole practice of tipping in restaurants has become a major news story in America, with many places now following the lead set by a restaurant called Sushi Yasuda in Manhattan. And Sushi Masuda now adds this note to the bill, or the check, as they confusingly say in the United States. I'll pay my check with a check. Following the custom in Japan, Sushi Yasuda's service staff are fully compensated by their salary. Therefore, gratuities are not accepted. Well, many top restaurants are following suit, either including a service charge or by abandoning the practice altogether. So, Magnus Shaw, when you visit Dominique Ansel's Bakery in Soho, New York next month to sample cronuts, will you be leaving a 20% minimum gratuity?
Oh, tipping, it's the Englishman's nightmare, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah. By way of contrast to your average American who does it, you know, by nature, doesn't it? But the Englishman gets in a terrible flap about it. I know I certainly do. And I don't mind tipping. I'm not one of these people who says, no, I've paid for what I've had and I'm paying no more. I don't go for that. You know, I understand that, you know, the industries in which you tip are usually low paid industries, and there's a lot of expectation of tipping. And if I've had good service, then I think it's a very amenable way of demonstrating that. However, the practicalities of it are dreadful in that I come to a tipping situation and reach into my pocket, I've either got a 20p piece or a 20 or a £20 note, neither of which is going to be sufficient for either party. On a purely selfish basis, the elimination of tipping would take a lot of anxiety away from me, but I do understand why it's desirable for the people who get tips. Of course I do.
I was going to say note, but you just got a £20 note. I was at a church service. It was an anniversary mass last Sunday, and they do a collection in Catholic churches.
Yeah, I'm an Anglican church.
Oh, do they? Okay, right. And I did exactly that. I thought, oh my God, because I'd forgotten completely. I, you know, it's a very rare day when you find me in a church. And I had a £20 note in my wallet and a £1 coin. And I felt like really a cheapskate putting a £1 coin in. So I thought, well, I'm not bunging 20 quid in.
Well, £1 is sort of on the borderline of
just acceptable.
I mean, I suppose not for a restaurant tip, but you know,
in the church. Yes.
But you know, it's when you get down into the shrapnel and the silver, and you think, shall I give them nothing, which is probably the worst option of all, or shall I give them like 8p?
well, you're right. I mean, the whole thing of tipping is fraught. Yeah. And I think the worst bit is when you're paying by card, not so much in cash, because they bring you the little machine and they hand it to you. Yeah. And it has this little message springs up on the screen. It says, if you wish to add a gratuity, press yes.
Yeah, now I always avoid that. I always press no, just for the simple fact that I do know, and I have heard from friends who've, you know, been waiting staff.
Yes.
That, you know, that is programmed in by management. And it, you know, if you press yes and add £3, that doesn't always go to your waiter.
Oh, I see. Because, I get in this sort of sociological embarrassment situation. And I think I can't hit no because, you know, the fellow or the girl is standing there smiling sweetly and making small talk. So, you know, I kind of go into, like, I'm a character in an Alan Ayckbourn drama. You know, I feel I've got to, you know, society demands I add a fiver.
Yeah, I would always rather press no and then put some pound coins down, because just in case, it's a bit of a ruse by management. And I don't know which outlets are you know, villains in that piece and which are, you know, giving you a new or alternative means of tipping your waiter, but I refuse to take that risk, really. So
I did some research, seeing this subject coming up, and I found advice from the CNN money experts, and this refers to America. They suggest you should tip the waiter or waitress 20%. Add in an extra tip for the head waiter or captain, again, as they say in America, the captain, 15% of the cost of the bottle for the sommelier or wine waiter, 20% of the tab to the bartender. While you're waiting for your table, you might have a drink at the bar. You've got to give him 20%. $1 for the coat room attendant, $2 for the parking valet, which seems a bit mean, and 50 cents to $1 for the washroom attendant, which also seems less than generous. But incidentally, Magnus, I just want to say, I don't want an attendant sitting at a table in the washroom. Thanks very much.
No, indeed not. No, it's an unnecessary feature of any restaurant, isn't it?
I would say so. So you better take a big wadge of dollar bills with you next
month.
Well,
you say dollar bills, you see, and I wonder whether this doesn't have some bearing on it. Because, of course, in America, before you get into the loose change, you can come down to the dollar bill. And if you spent any time in the States, you'll know that you glance at your wallet and you think, hey, I'm not doing too bad on my spending money here. Look, there's a good old slice of notes here in my wallet. And then you get back to the hotel and then, you know, empty your wallet out and they're all dollar bills, which, although you've spent far more than you at first thought, because we're not used to low denomination notes, are we? It does make tipping easier to have a lot of dollar bills.
Yes, I suppose so. You know, one last thought on this whole business of restaurant eating is I can't bear it. I never do this myself, so I refuse to be party to it. But if I'm sitting at a table and the table next to me have just received their check or bill, and they start to wrangle over it. You know, someone says, now, you had a starter, but I had an extra glass of Coke. So you've got to put in £9.30. Yeah. Oh God, I can't bear that. It makes me squirm just hearing those conversations.
The only time when the reverse is true, when there really should be some divvying up, is if you go on a works do. I mean, we're both freelance, but at times when you work for an office, you go on a works do, and you know, towards the end of the month, or you're saving up for a holiday or whatever. You know, times are a bit tight. You think, I'm just going to have the medium pizza. And a soft drink, that'll do for me. I haven't got that much, disposable about me. And everybody sits down and have their meal. And then at the end, somebody goes, we'll just split it eight ways, okay? And you look down the table and somebody's had, like, prime steak and extra large French fries, two salads and four beers. Yeah. And you know that you're going to be subsidising their gluttony there. Now, that's really annoying.
Well, you see, that's the other side of the coin. But I'm now putting you in the descriptor of these people. You see, they're like, well, you know, you had the steak, but I only had pizza. Therefore, you know, I only have to pay £4.70 as opposed to your.
I think what you do is, you know, on arrival, you say, I'm going to pay my own guys, if that's all right. I'm a little short. I'm going to pay my own.
Oh, well, that's reasonable. Yeah, that's perfect.
But if you forget to do that, you can get badly stung by the guy down the end who's had a 20-ounce T-bone steak and four desserts.
So, clue, if Desperate Dan is part of your dinner group, then you know you're in trouble.
Well, I think some people think, oh, as we'll be splitting it evenly, I'm going to go nuts. I think that's what
Oh, dear. Now, Magnus, your technology, of course, never stands still, as Senator John McCain found this week as he was photographed playing poker on his smartphone during a Senate hearing on the use of force in Syria. And worst of all, I lost, he tweeted. Now, perhaps Senator McCain will find it more discreet to play games on the new Samsung Galaxy Gear smartwatch, which was launched this week, $299 in the USA and coming to the UK in a couple of weeks. The Galaxy Gear smartwatch, just thinking of it makes me laugh, I'm so sorry, responds to voice commands, answers phone calls, it enables you to buy stuff on eBay, works as a pedometer, takes photos. You'll be first in the queue for one of these, won't you, Magnus Shaw?
Well, we've absolutely reached the point now where the fantasy of our childhood has become the reality, hasn't it? Because in all our comics and Batman TV shows and science fiction movies, when we were growing up in the 60s and 70s, somebody was talking into their watch, weren't they?
Yes.
Without fail.
Wearing a silver suit.
Yeah, without fail. Somebody communicated by talking into their watch, and now we're actually going to do it. I know I've said in the past that people do not want to wear their technology. They want to keep it in their pocket. And I still stand by that. I think you know a lightweight rectangle in your pocket is still the most amenable way to access technology. And I think some kind of rectangle will still be the way forward, no matter how sophisticated the gear inside it becomes. But the Galaxy Gear wristwatch is sort of in the grey area where it isn't too bad. And I had a look at these, and they're actually all right, aren't they? If you like a big watch. I mean, I don't
like,
I know
you
don't
like
a watch at all.
I don't wear one, so yeah.
Well, I like watches.
Useless to
me. I'm a bit fetishistic about watches. I quite like wristwatches. And these don't look too bad. I mean, they don't look like a phone strap to your wrist. They do look like a albeit very chunky, digital watch. Very much like those digital watches we got when we were...
Yes.
Kids in the 80s when we could afford a digital watch for the first time. They're not that dissimilar. And they don't look too bad. If somebody were to give me one, Galaxy Gear, are you listening to the podcast? If somebody were to give me one, I would probably happily wear it and give it a go. Hmm. But I still think it's an unnecessary diversion from the handy rectangle that you carry in your pocket.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, as you say, I don't wear a watch. So for me, everything that this can do, I can do on virtually any phone. So, you know, what's the point for me? Yet another example, though, for the potential of stealth photography, which is troubling. You know, it's got a camera on the wristband, and you just point the little pinhole camera to your subject,
yes,
and you can take a photo. That I don't know, yeah, that's
gonna become,
just a little bit worrying.
No, that's going to become problematic as we go forward. I read a tweet from somebody in the week, and they said, I think they must move in very different circles from me. They said, I'm in a restaurant, two people just joined our party wearing Google Glass.
Whoa,
Google glasses, we should say, really. But
yeah,
Google Glass. The table fell silent until they left. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, isn't it? Yes, that sort of gives its own story. And, I'm still to see one in the wild. And,
I am too, yes. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean there. They must move in different circles from me. And indeed, if I was...
I would be wobbly. If I saw someone sitting at the table with a Galaxy Gear smartwatch, yes, and they kept pointing the wristband around the room, it would make me sort of think, well, what are you up to?
Exactly,
you know?
Yes, yeah. And to be honest, if I was in a restaurant and somebody joined the party wearing Google glasses, like, I'd either depart or empty my bolognese over their head for just being so daft.
Yes. I suspect their value, the more I think about it, for your Google Glass will be out on the streets for navigating, or if you're standing around on a corner waiting to meet somebody or something of that nature. In other words, more when you're mobile rather than seated around a restaurant. I think that would be grotesque.
Then, even then, is it not eventually or even quite rapidly going to encourage people to just point and say a word that we can't use on the podcast?
Yeah.
I just think it was gonna, if they do have their day, I think they're just going to become the emblem of a complete tool.
Well, sitting around a table in a cafe or restaurant, you wouldn't know whether the person is actually interacting with you or watching an old episode of Seinfeld,
exactly.
Would you?
I just say, if you want to talk to me, take those bloody things off. They're very much, to my mind, the same as those Bluetooth earpieces.
Oh, God, yes. They're,
and if you encountered anybody wearing one of those when they were all the rage, you would just immediately think, you are some kind of...
Yes, twerp.
Yes.
I thought the other main tech news of the week was an April Fool type of gag, but apparently not. Hmm. Google is to call the next version of its mobile operating system Android KitKat, named, of course, after the chocolate bar. And as Google say, no money has changed hands either way. What the devil is all this about, Magna Shaw?
it is bizarre, isn't it? And when you read the news stories, I mean, I read this through a couple of times. I still couldn't work out whether there was going to be a chocolate bar available that was somehow had an operating system in it, or vice versa. I think it's vice versa. I think you'll buy something with an operating system called KitKat, but it was not entirely clear. Then it occurred to me, after much pondering, that updates to Android are always named after confectionery.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Oh, I didn't realise that.
Updates to Apple operating systems are always named after felines, the snow leopard and such like, a tiger.
You're way ahead of us here, I see.
And updates to Android operating systems, the Google operating system, are always named after confectionery. But this is the first time it's been branded confectionery. So.
I see. Well, if this chocolate bar affiliation sort of really took off, I thought, you know, what's coming next? And I thought, well, we could have Spotify Snickers, Yahoo Yorkie, Amazon Aero,
yes,
Kindle Kinder Eggs.
Yes, or Kindle Eggs.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Nokia Nestle, but... Rocking Vicar Rolos.
Who could object to that? But I particularly like Kindle Eggs. That's very clever.
Yes,
well, you want to be all over that with the lawyers. Yeah, that.
Well, Magna Shaw Milky Way.
Yes, certainly Magna Shaw, not an operating system. Mind you, neither are any of the other things you've mentioned.
No.
But that Kindle Egg, that's crying out for a campaign, that's it.
Isn't it?
Yes, award-winning.
Yeah. I think I may... trundle down the patent office immediately after this podcast. Now, Magna Shaw, to cut a long story short, you've been lunching with the stars again.
Yeah, I did. Monday took me to the Fair Village of London town, and I was at BBC Worldwide, and there I met up with Tony Hadley from Spandau Ballet, and I got underway by asking Tony what exactly he's up to at the moment.
Just finishing off the album. And got about another 4 or 5 days of recording left, and then it's mixing. And it's the first album I've ever actually done that is completely written, co-written by me. It's sounding great, and I've sort of gone back to my roots, in a sense. So then we've just got to get mixed. It's sounding great. It's sounding really, really good, so... It's always good when you get a big smile on your face, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good sign, isn't it? Yeah.
So it's great when it comes together.
Yeah.
So
has it got a title yet?
No, that's always the tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the trick. I've got a couple of ideas.
Okay.
So,
nothing you're letting on to. No, all right, fair enough. So once that's all done, by my reckoning, you've got the orchestral shows almost straight after, have you?
Yeah, I've got the orchestral shows in October, I think, 13th at Bridgewater Hall, Manchester, Symphony Hall on the 15th in Birmingham, then Royal Albert Hall on the 16th of October. So that's, again, it's going to be an interesting combination, because the first half of the show will be, I mean, it's basically the Tony Hadley band, so it's a core rock band, surrounded by the London Symphony Orchestra. And so they have all the strings and timps and brass, and it was going to sound, and Dudley conducting, so it'll sound really lush and beautiful.
And Dudley from Art of Noise.
Art of Noise, yeah. ABC, Frankie, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, she's great.
She's really, she's got a great kind of orchestral stroke pop sensibility, so... She knows what makes it, enhances that kind of pop rock core, if you like. So that's going to be really interesting. And then I've always had a bit of a thing about not performing Muscle Bound. I don't know.
Why? What's
well,
the... It's a very different Spandau track, isn't it? On that first album, it sounds very different from the rest of the album.
I mean, there was myself going through that very kind of Mario Lanza, we're building, you know, kind of, oh.
Yeah, it's very, very cinematic, isn't it?
I'm not even sure what it's about. It's one of those obscure Gary Kemp lyrics. And,
well, I can remember sitting around with my mates trying to work that out.
So, you know, we're building
exactly
fires
his muscle,
that will burn onto more.
It had a sort of a Soviet sort of revolutionary sort of industrial
thing. It was that kind of thing. I think that was the kind of thing behind it. And then the video was Dwarfs and Horses and, us in the lakes.
It was the 80s, Wookie.
Well, yeah. Hey, let's go to the Lake District and get some dwarfs and some horses. Yeah. And we all looked like Robin Hood and all kind of. It was pretty surreal, you know. So with the timpani, you could make you could actually make it very, and maybe pizzicato strings and such.
Yeah.
I can
see that. Yeah.
So we think it could work.
I was thinking about Instinction last night, and that's always, for me, a standout Spandau track, but it's not the one that gets picked up by radio or stuff, but I think that, for me, is a real standout.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. I mean, I think the remix version, that is, you know, that's kind of had the wow factor, and it was at a point in Spandau's time when, I mean, the one thing, you get to the point where you get the record deal, and you go, yes, we've done it, and then you get to the point where you go, we've got to follow up the single. And cut long story short, obviously, it was number five, which was fantastic. But then I think Paint Me Down was that the second single? The Freeze
was the second single. Yeah.
Wow. Glad you reminded me. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But The Freeze was the second single, and that got to number 17. And, of course, there were people there. Yes, we told you they were only one-hit wonders.
But I really liked The Freeze.
Yeah, The Freeze was kind really of, good. You know, I mean, but we had a... We had a couple of dicky points around there. So Instinction really was, I think, She Loved Like Diamond and Paint Me Down didn't do terribly well, if I remember rightly. And Instinction, come the second album, was, you know, Trevor came in with Ann Dudley, I redid the vocals, and all of a sudden went to number 10.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, Saved by the Bell kind of thing, you know.
But by way of contrast to the orchestral shows, which are going to be these grand affairs, the DVD is just goes to the other end of the scale.
Yeah.
It's about as intimate as you can get with a rock show, isn't it?
Well, we filmed it in Metropolis, and it was a very close. I mean, we were so
looked hot.
I got to tell you, I didn't realise quite how small a venue the studio was, really. I mean, you know, the gap between probably the band and the back wall was probably the width of this room.
Yeah.
It was tight as a duck's. I like to move on stage. Uh-huh. I like to, you know, I'm used to kind of big stages. And as I've turned to the right, I've hit, my temples hit Phil Williams, our bass player's, the head of his bass. Just on the top of my eye on the temple, and I swung around, flipping hurt. Wow.
Oh,
I put his bass out of tune as well. So really, really hurt, you know. So there wasn't a lot of room to move.
It's not all Tony Hadley and Spandau stuff, is it?
No.
Starts with Life on Mars.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got Somebody Told Me on there.
Big fan of the Killers, big fan of Bowie's. The Killers are a big fan of the Bowie's as well.
I was going to ask, are there songs with particular meaning for you, or did you just think they'd sound good live? Or?
No, I mean, I'm, you know, I grew up with Bowie, you know, Ziggy, Loud Insane.
Yeah.
My first ever album was The World of David Bowie.
Yes.
Who my mum thought sounded like Anthony Newley. Is that a new
Anthony
Newley record?
He did sound like Anthony
Newley.
That's right.
He's very much like that. And so, you know, it had like Uncle Arthur and Little Boy Blue on it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I really got into Bowie at a very early age. The Killers are one of my favourite bands.
Yeah.
I think Brown and Flowers is a great frontman. Got a super voice.
When his solo album was terrific.
Yeah, I got his solo album. Yeah, I'm a big fan. Yeah. Big fan of the bands. Somebody told me it's just, you know, I just love the energy of it, you know. Yeah. Well, somebody told me you had a boyfriend who looked like a girlfriend that I had in February of last year. It's not confidential, I've got potential.
So 2009, Spandau was back together.
Yeah.
And you toured in 2010. It seemed from the outside a successful project. Did it seem like that for you?
I'll be honest with you, we were all quite worried as to how we were going to be received. Mm. I mean, obviously, there's the court case and everything else and the falling out. And we hadn't spoken to each other in years. I mean, myself, Johnny Keeble, obviously, he's in the DVD, plays drums and has been looking at my backside for 23 years as a solo artist, you know. But, no, so getting back with Spanner was, you know, we finally put, you know, laid the ghost to rest and put it behind us, all the horribleness and the angst and the anger and stuff, and I'm really glad we did. I do think we're a better bunch of lads for doing it as well, because it's a kind of bit of a weird one, really, because you don't think it affects you, you know. Some people are actually quite good. I don't care, I'm moving on. And for me, and I think the rest of the guys, if you look at our history and where we came from school and everything else, it did bother me. And even though I might have poo-pooed it and, you know, and everything else, it niggles away. Mm. So I think when we got back together again, it was a really good thing to do. And we had a laugh. Went on tour and we had a right laugh. We had some giggles and stuff. And it was really funny because I remember when we first kicked off in the rehearsal studios, I mean, Martin and John had really honed down there. You know, Martin had been literally practicing and watching the DVDs, and because I don't think Martin picked up a bass in... Sure. Long time,
he'd
of course.
Been acting, hadn't he?
Yeah, he'd been doing acting. Yeah, yeah. Gary was pretty much the same. Steve had been doing a bit here and there. Mm-hmm. But the two sort of traditionalists, if you like, in music were Johnny Keeble and myself. Mm-hmm. So I'd been gigging ever since we ever broke up. So for me, it's a walk in the park. I'm going on stage again. Brilliant. You know, I did that last week.
Yes.
But I remember Gary said, John Keeble said that Gary said to him, he said in rehearsal, he said, we've been rehearsing a few weeks. He said, oh, I'm really worried. He said, Tone seems really laid back about the whole thing. And and I'm pretty laid back anyway. He said, you know, he's got lyrics everywhere. And, you know, he's... And Johnny Kay just said, oh, don't worry about Tone. He'll be cool. He'll be fine. And on the day of the first gig in Dublin, you know, I was sent to someone else that you know, there was me wandering around in my underpants, you know, with 15 minutes. I'd done my vocal exercises and the rest of the guys are all suiting and booting. I'm going, oh, yeah, where did I put that? Yeah, okay. And everyone's thinking, we're going on stage in a minute. And, you know,
that's probably a good sign.
I was nervous. Don't get me wrong. I always get nervous before a show, whether it's my own or Spandau. And then that particular Dublin show, I think, you know, we were all a little bit nervous. But I like to try and just ease it back. And not let the nerves take too much of a hold. And I just don't think we realised what the reception was going to be like. And at the end of the day, we did 13 arena shows.
Yeah.
And thanks very much. And the fans were terrific. So, yeah.
Do you think it's important to go through the legal stuff to clear the air after, you know, all that success? Do you think you needed some kind of catharsis before you could come back together? Or you'd rather not have
I'd rather have not that? Gone through it. I mean, you know, I truth be told, I really wish that the situation that predated the problem, if you like, it was as it was, because I think it would have allowed us as a band to have at least been sociable together, and got together and had the odd meal and gone, oh God, you remember when we did this and that, but things did change, and I think it was unfortunate that they changed, but that's the way it was. And losing a court case is never easy, but you know, you do what you think is right at the time. Yeah, it's very expensive in the High Court, 23 days.
But, I can believe that.
But you know, I'm always a great believer in bouncing back, and you have to move forward, and that's the same with music. I mean, once I've done it, I'm on to the next project. In the current state of the music market, we would never have got to the True Out if we'd been signed in the present day. Because Journey to Glory wasn't a worldwide success. It sold okay. I mean, but in the hundreds, you know, a couple of hundred thousand, if you like. We broke a few territories. The second album, we were way down, both in the UK and elsewhere. So we would have been dropped in present day.
Yes.
But Chrysalis, bless them, really stuck with us in the days when record companies did stick with bands and allowed us to go away. We were not A&R'd or anything like that. Went away and made the True album, and True became number one in 21 countries around the world. It changed our lives completely. Absolutely. I mean, it was like, it was kind of crazy, and it also took us to the teen screen thing as well, whereby
Spandaumania.
Spandaumania. It was us and the Duranis and a lot of parents were like going, you know, mums were going, oh, he looks ever so nice. He looks like a nice boy, smart, you know. And there was, you know, you had Duran and Spandau and various other bands making these Gone with the Wind type videos. Our extravagant.
It was very noticeable. None of you ever went to Scunthorpe to make your videos, did you?
That really, and interestingly, in those days, you didn't have to pay the money back. It was considered marketing. Really, really interesting period. Very creative and very exciting for, you know, I was 23 when True went to number one. I mean, great period. Really good period.
Tony, thank you very
much.
It's been lovely speaking to you.
Thank
you very much.
He sounds like a nice fellow. Sounds like a good chap.
A decent gent, I have to say. It was very nice to spend some time in his company, and he looked well on it. He just got back from holiday, so he had a bit of a glow about him. And he's still very handsome, has to be said.
Yeah, very good. Well, I was at the Scala in King's Cross when, you know, their launch party, when Spandau Ballet had their launch, when Robert Elms read this terrible poem as an introduction. They were very good, but I think the hype nearly got in the way, back then.
Yeah, because he did all the sleeve notes on Journeys to Glory, didn't he, Robert Elms? Sort of touching on philosophy and ancient Greek history and stuff. So, all very pretentious. So was their first gig not on the HMS Belfast, I think?
Oh, I don't know. I just remember them in the Scala.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, members of the band were wearing kind of like kilts.
Oh, they would be, yes. Yeah. Right. That was very much their thing. And Tony has a good laugh about that, actually. Talking about the old outfits. Yeah.
I can imagine. Anyway, that was good fun and sounded like, as I say, a good fellow to me.
Yeah, really, absolutely. Funnily enough, after he spoke to me, he went off for an interview with Robert Elms. Really?
There's symmetry
absolutely. He went off to Radio London to do a thing with Robert Elms, so
I wonder if Robert reread that.
Let's hope not.
I hope not. A couple of weeks ago, Kevin Spacey gave the annual McTaggart interview at the Edinburgh Television Festival. Incidentally, he was introduced on stage as the sexy Kevin Spacey, and it's just struck me. Imagine the outcry if a woman giving a serious lecture was introduced in such a way. I mean, Twitter would explode.
No, this is true. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. There is a double standard there.
There is.
Yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, just to digress for a second, there's a commercial running at the moment on TV where a woman, obviously married woman, in order to gain enough time to indulge her bingo habit, her online bingo habit, has her husband snatched gaffer tapes and thrown into the back of a van, which then drives off. She breathes a sigh of relief and starts playing her online bingo. Now, can you imagine if it was the man who needed time to have a can of beer or watch football or something, had his wife snatched by masked men and gaffer taped and thrown into the back of the van. That wouldn't play the same way at all, would it?
Heads would roll, yeah, right across the media world, from the advertising agency to the broadcaster.
Indeed, yeah.
And the front page of the Sun and the Mail would be on fire. Yes.
Yes. Yes. A similar thing. Yeah. Yeah. Although my mum would wholly agree with Kevin Spacey's description as sexy. She wouldn't object to that.
Okay, the sexy Kevin Spacey, he told the audience that we are in a third golden age of television, with programmes such as Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones and Mad Men, bringing top-quality drama to our screens. In a strange sort of twist, he criticised US networks for their obsession with running pilots before committing to a full season. But do you think Kevin Spacey is right? Is this the golden age of the not-so-small screen, I suppose, these days? And if so, if we're in this golden age, why is Strictly Come Dancing returning to haunt Saturday nights in the UK from now till Christmas?
Well, he's right and wrong, isn't he? What we're actually in is the golden age of HBO, or at least HBO-inspired programming. In other words, your serial dramas from the United States.
Box set
States.
Drama almost.
Box set drama, exactly. Which, of course, is of an extraordinarily high standard. And really, there are too many to get involved in. I mean, can you follow Mad Men, Game of Thrones, House of Cards, Breaking Bad, The American? Can you follow all these simultaneously? You can't.
No, I can't, sadly. No, I have to pick and choose. I tend to go for recommendations.
Exactly.
But
the menu available is of gourmet quality, isn't it? So when you do say, do you know what, I'm going to follow one of those, you're more than likely going to be following a very good one. So, yes, of course he's right. For box set drama, as you rightly describe it, it is a golden age. I think people look back and say, good Lord, why? How come that all happened at once? But generally speaking, across the TV industry, you know, it could equally be argued that things are rather dire. I think they're probably worse maybe 5 or 6 years ago when ITV were really failing. When we had shows like Celebrity Shark Bait, for instance.
Oh, good grief.
It's worth saying, when Michael Grade was running ITV, things were pretty bad, pretty bad. Much better now, I think. I mean, who'd have thought ITV would, within a few years, really nudge ahead in the drama stakes? Because for a good while, ITV didn't do drama, didn't run drama, too expensive, not their thing. And now they, you know, with Downton Abbey and some of their police stuff, the procedural stuff, really nudging ahead of the BBC. So there has been a turnaround, but the golden age across every channel, not so sure.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, and I think it almost Downton Abbey stands out as a little beacon on ITV, doesn't it, really? And I think that's been sustained by their ability to sell it overseas, particularly to America, where amazingly Downton Abbey is even bigger than it is over here.
Oh, it is, yes, yeah. But ITV have some other stuff as well. I think Vera is very successful. Scott and Bailey, very successful. Like I say, when you consider sort of half a decade ago, they had a policy of not making original drama and making Celebrity Shark Bait instead,
then
things have turned around. So I don't think it's absolute nadir of TV broadcasting. But like you say, Strictly Come Dancing returns, and we think, if this is the golden age, then take me back to the bronze age, really.
Yes, we're back to the iron age the stone age with Strictly. I guess so. So our conclusion really is perhaps not so much a golden age, but a mixed bag where there's some very, very good television, but also some stuff that we'll gladly let go past us without troubling us too much.
Yes, but of course we're in the minority. I mean, the reason Strictly Come Dancing is returning is that it's absolutely phenomenally popular, you know. So, so it's all right for Statler and Waldorf here to sit here carping on, but people want it, you know. It does well for the BBC, and seems to be perfect Saturday night fare. But as I have very little interest in inverted commas celebrities, and no interest whatsoever in ballroom dancing, it's a bit hard to pull me in on that one, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, me too. It won't be keeping me in on Saturday nights. Anyone who knows me will not be shocked that the whole MasterChef TV franchise has passed me by. MasterChef, well, it hasn't troubled me, and I haven't caused it any issues either. My culinary skills are limited to having a vague idea of how long to keep the pasta in the pan. Yes. once there's a sizzling sound and smoke coming up, and I know, oh, that's probably done. So I was surprised to learn that MasterChef has been running in the UK since 1990, and the celebrity version since 2006. And the first celebrity season featured your mate Tony Hatley.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, he didn't win it, but he was in it.
How interesting. How interesting. Yeah.
This week saw the denouement of the 2013 celebrity version of MasterChef, and we watched the episode on Wednesday when four contenders became three. And these four contestants, I pictured them as sort of cooking Spice Girls, so I gave them all a nickname. So there was Brian Capron, who I nicknamed Scary, Aid Edmondson, Cheery.
Oh, right, yes.
Janet Street Porter, Brooding. And Les Dennis, Desperate. So, Magnus Shaw, were you on the edge of your sofa wearing oven gloves, aching to be baking afternoon tea at 1 Aldwych with Janet Street Porter?
Oh, no, I wouldn't have any desire whatsoever to be involved in the programme itself. I noticed Lloyd Grossman's role has diminished greatly since I last watched MasterChef, but he certainly seems to have taken a back seat. But I think you're being a bit unfair on the competitors there, because actually what struck me is that actually the competitors were all really rather decent stand-up people, by way of contrast to some of these celebrity shows where you would gladly throttle any number of them. They all actually were quite...
They were very earnest.
They were. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? I think the word that sprung to mind watching MasterChef, and like you, I have never taken the time to watch it before, so yeah. I was new to all this. But the word that sprang to mind watching this was jeopardy. The whole deal is built around jeopardy, just like The Apprentice, just like Dragon's Den. This is jeopardy television, isn't it? Is that you take people, members of the public and or the semi-famous, and put them in jeopardy. And then of course the inevitable experts then judge their abject failure in handling that jeopardy. It's a well-worn format now, isn't it? But what is particularly interesting is that they are as emotionally entangled in this jeopardy, in these cooking tasks, as those businessmen pitching for their very livelihoods on Dragon's Den. The same number of tears, anxiety, yeah, furrowed brows, trembling hands. Overcooking. It seems to be out of proportion to the actual activity, the emotional impact that the competition has on them. It's extraordinary.
Better than giving birth, said Janet Stewart-Porter about baking brioche.
Well, most things are better than giving birth, aren't they? It's supposed to be extraordinarily painful, but I know what she meant. Yes, yeah.
Yes, well, I'm talking about the involvement. I found it difficult to feel involvement, I have to say, but rather unlike you. I felt a kind of lack of warmth on my part towards the contenders. And I didn't think they didn't bring much character. None of them were able to ad lib. We had these sound bites to character, I just thought, you know, these shows that come from America are often on MTV. Is it The Hills and Orange County and stuff? And you know, like they're semi-scripted, like we have over here, don't we? The Only Way is Essex.
Geordie Shore,
that's it. If they had semi-scripted it like that, so that these celebrities had something of value or tangible to say to the camera when they were giving their sound bites, that would have added something. You know, even if it had been sort of smart aleck remarks or something. Mm. But they just said something like, oh, it's getting really hot in here now, or, oh, time's running out, I hope I make it. You know, and I thought, well, you know, you're scraping the barrel there for sound bites, and I thought that detracted from it. They needed a writer.
Well, you say that. I think in the BBC's eyes, that would make it a very different show. And so when these things are semi-scripted, any number of people jump up and down saying, this isn't reality, you know, I bet the audience don't know this is all scripted, and people get very sceptical and cynical, so they can't really win on that front. But yes, I guess, and I'm not really saying that the whole thing was an engrossing experience. I was fairly pleased when it wrapped up and I could get on with things, because I'm not that fascinated, as I say, by celebrities or in this instance by cooking, but. Yeah, it does that journey thing, doesn't it?
It does, and the judging phase was very similar to the Great British Bake Off, wasn't
exactly,
it? With the
exactly.
Heart-beating music, though, yes, with this one. It's a music bed. Boom, boom,
and,
boom,
and the,
boom,
and the Apprentice and Dragon's Den. It's more or less a plug-and-play formula, this. But it does work to an extent. Like I said, the only disconnect was, how come these people are so upset or tense about a cooking competition? There's nothing hangs on it for them. They can all go back to their careers just as they did before. All that's hanging on it is whether their scones taste that nice. So it does seem a bit overwrought.
You make a very good point, because I can understand the desperation of Mr. and Miss Joe Public when they're in the Big Brother house or on any of these, as you rightly call them, Jeopardy shows, because it's their one shot at fame, and they're worried that if they go early, then they'll never be remembered, and they get desperate.
Yes, or if, in this instance, they were competing to get a top job chefing at the top restaurants, you know, their career.
Or for £1 million or something.
Exactly.
But these people can all go back to probably better lives.
I know.
It must be just getting caught up in the moment.
Yes.
The adrenaline and all of that.
And I have to say, the cooking tasks, especially the stuff they did at One Aldwych, were terribly difficult. I mean, really, really, really difficult. And the Pearly Kings and Queens...
who ate it all,
said it was 10 out of 10, so they did well.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting then to be further cooking after that, I must say.
That surprised me too, Magnus Shaw. We've headed off to the MasterChef kitchen in London's wonderful Islington to make tarts and ice cream. That was a bit odd. It was like an add-on.
Yes, well, quite an extensive one as well.
It was the length
of the show, and I thought this is the cooking task that we're seeing right here when they were in One Aldwych. So rather surprised to say, now here's another cooking task. Is it?
Here we go again.
I thought we'd just watched a bunch of cooking, you know, which indeed we had. So that sort of stretched it a bit for me. But it's well made. It's a well made show.
Beautifully filmed. Mm,
and it did hold my attention. And some of the food looked great. I mean, blueberry parfait lollipops with chocolate coating. I'm all about that. That looked great. Really good to me. Not so much the cakes, but those blueberry parfait lollipops looked just terrific to me.
They did indeed, yes. And there was a luscious, sensuous narration by India Fisher in the best sort of Julie Peascod style, which helped sort of us feel involved with the food.
And interestingly enough, I noticed, talking about people who appeared in the credits, I think production designer is called Catfish.
Oh, I was just going to mention that. Yeah, wonderfully named Catfish. She was the director.
Oh, director. Well, sorry, yeah.
She was the director for Shine.
I missed her job title, but couldn't help noticing she was called Catfish,
I know, what else? You could only go into the media with a name like that.
And indeed, cookery programmes.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So it was indeed directed by that delicately named Catfish for Shine. Yeah. Celebrity MasterChef, Wednesday, BBC One, 8 o'clock. And by the time you hear this, we're recording this on Friday morning. By the time you hear this, the winner will be known, and there'll be tears.
Oh,
and,
is that right? Okay, yeah.
Yes, angel cake all round, no doubt. The end of the TV review brings us to our closing feature, the Pretend iPod. Magnus Shaw and I both pick a track of music, and we tell you why we like it. And then we stick it on this Pretend iPod on the Rocking Vicar website, and it's also on Spotify under the name of Magnus Shaw on Spotify. So, anyway, my pick this week... Former music hall star Tessie O'Shea, known as Two-Ton Tessie O'Shea because of her size. Oh, no, hold on. Oh, I'm telling you again, that's not right. No. It's not Tutun Tessie O'Shea. It's Timothy B. Schmidt of the Eagles.
Oh, him, yeah.
Always get those two muddled up. It's so easy to do.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Tessie O'Shea played drums in Poco in the 1970s. Yeah. So, that's... Yeah. I'll fix that in the edit. Well, I'll cut that bit out, along with the nomenclature bit. I always found the Eagles a bit meh. Their output of Californian country soft rock always felt a little lacking, less genuine than near contemporaries like Emmylou Harris, New Riders of the Purple Sage, J.D. South, or indeed Poco, as aforementioned. That was until my great guitar hero, Joe Walsh, and then that immaculate bass player with the sweetest voice, Timothy B. Schmidt, joined the band. I can remember seeing Joe Walsh on the All Grey Whistle Test in the early 1970s and going out and buying his first solo album the next day. And I was a big fan of Poco with their faultless harmonies based around that angelic voice of Timothy B. Schmidt. Since joining the Eagles, Timothy B. Schmidt's opportunities to feature his songs and vocals have been limited, but today I'm featuring a track of his from the Eagles album, The Long Run, and it's also one of my Desert Island Discs, one of my top tunes of all time. Coincidentally, this track also features in one of my favourite movies, Shoot the Moon, with Albert Finney and Diane Keaton. It's on the soundtrack now. I Can't Tell You Why is a beautifully constructed song with lyrics that simply tell of a relationship that isn't working, but the couple just keep walking back to each other because there's something just too strong holding them together. Subtly produced by Bill Simzik, all of the Eagles understate their parts. Laid-back drums from Don Henley, tender piano by Glenn Frey, Don Felder on gentle guitar, keyboards Joe Walsh, and the gorgeous bass lines and unsurpassable vocals from Timothy B. Schmidt. And oh, those harmonies. Released February 4th, 1980, reached number 8 on the Billboard Hot 100, nowhere on the UK Top 40, 4 minutes, 59 seconds. The Eagles, I Can't Tell You Why.
Does it actually say on the record sleeve, Glenn Frey gentle guitar?
No, that's my unique description of the skills that he brings.
I see. Fair enough. There's something about something about growing old, which we're both doing rapidly.
I'm good at that game, yes.
That endears you to the Eagles, because of course, as a raggedy, wild-haired punk rocker in my teens, I can't think of a band that represented the antithesis of everything I liked about music better than the Eagles. And now, as a middle-aged man, I quite like the Eagles.
Same here.
I know.
Very much. They were exactly the devil incarnate when you were jumping up and down to the Pistols or the Damned in a London bar in 76, sure. 77 with their, you know, long strung out guitar solos and so on. But now in retrospect, even the stuff before the sort of punk era, which, as I say, had a kind of not too... It didn't feel sort of verified sort of country rock. It felt quite poppy. But I now think all the better for that. One of These Nights sounds fantastic now. And great sing-alongers in the car, the Eagles' greatest hits.
Yeah, absolutely. And we slam them on when we're in the States in the car.
Because
it goes together quite well, I think. It's a quintessential American band. And, of course, the second entry for the Eagles on our pretend iPod, the first one being the atypical Eagles track, The Journey of the Sorcerer, which is that.
Yes, and at the time, you couldn't find the original because the Eagles' oeuvre wasn't on Spotify. No. I'm delighted to say that in the last month, the Eagles have come to an arrangement with Spotify and their entire works are now available on Spotify, hence my selection as they've just appeared.
Excellent, very good indeed, very good indeed. So, well, I picked something very un-Eagles-like, but I'll tell you a little bit of a story before we go into it. Over a coffee, somebody once asked me, and it's a good question this, somebody once asked me what I considered to be the best song with which to open a radio show. You can think about that for a long time. But obviously we were just having a coffee and then moving on. So I threw out a couple of suggestions. I think I said there, perhaps Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, or even The Pretender's Message of Love would be quite a good one. But as I wandered off down the high street, I wasn't really satisfied that I'd nailed this particular poser. And my trivial brain gets hooked on these things, you know, so it really matters to me that I hadn't actually, totally given a succinct and correct answer in this instance. So anyway, I left that in my back brain. But a couple of months later, I heard the sainted Bob Harris trail his Radio 2 show by saying he'd be kicking it off with the best record one could ever use for this purpose.
Ooh.
I thought, oh, yes, well, I was just talking about that not so long ago. So I stuck around, and do you know what? He was absolutely right, because what he played at the top of his show was Bohemian Like You by the Dandy Warhols.
Oh, God, I'm with you now. Yeah. Good choice.
Now, there's so much to love about this record. Its introductory chord sequence, which follows those stomach-rumbling floor toms and wheezy Hammond notes, is so crunchily perfect that I doubt I've ever heard it without reaching for my Air Stratocaster. You gotta stand there and hammer out those opening chords. Then there's that tremendous lyric, which somehow tells a complete story in about half a dozen seemingly trivial questions. And while it's about it, it captures the exciting minutiae that accompanies the start of a love affair. In many ways, it's the perfect record from a rather underrated band, it has to be said. And if nothing else, of course, as Bob says, it's the best song you could ever select to open a radio show. It's also my pick for the Pretend iPod this week. That's the Dandy Warhols and Bohemian Like You.
It's a great choice. It's one of those songs that I play a lot, on sort of playlists I've got on Spotify or on the iPod or my own iPod or whatever. But I don't know much about the old Dandy Warhols, or I don't know much else of their output. But Bohemian Like You, as you say, great song. Once it's in your head, it stays there.
Yeah, it's got a cracking sing-along waha woohoo bit that runs through it as well.
You can never turn down a wahoo in a song.
Exactly.
No.
Well worth exploring the rest of the Dandy Warhols output, because although you could think of them as one-hit wonders with Bohemian Like You, that doesn't mean the quality drops at all when you hear their other stuff. Really good. I saw them supporting David Bowie as well. Last time I saw the Dame, the Dandy Warhols were supporting, which was a bit of a
Oh, right. I suppose with that nomenclature, the Dandy Warhols, I suppose Andy Warhols, what? David Bowie, maybe that's how they came to his attention.
Yeah, and you've got to admire a band that has a name that's so bad it's almost good.
Yeah.
They kind of rose to prominence alongside some pals of theirs who were in a band called the Brian Jonestown Massacre. So,
oh, right.
They'd obviously sat down and picked really excruciating puns for their band names, and it kind of works. There's a movie called Dig, which is about the rise and fall of the Brian Jonestown Massacre and the Dandy Warhols. And the Brian Jonestown Massacre never had the commercial success that the Dandy Warhols had. And this documentary is about the friction that caused in their friendship. Good movie, good rock movie, that's, yeah.
I often think that bands don't give enough time and thought to the name that they choose. It might be terribly funny when you're rehearsing in the village hall or in someone's garage to pick a silly name.
Oh, yeah.
But I think in the long run, it can be quite a handicap. I think it does stop people from sort of being sort of proud to say, well, look, I this is one of my favourite bands, if they've got a really stupid name. I always felt that Echo and the Bunnymen would have done, and Prefab Sprout would have done far, far better with less, in inverted commas, silly names.
Oh, well, I think Echo the Bunnymen's a great name for a band, actually. The Prefab Sprout, perhaps less so. I mean, Prefab Sprout, a bit like the Dandy Warhols, it's willfully bad, isn't it? So,
yes.
But I think we've got a plethora at the moment of bands with bad names, haven't we? I think Two Door Cinema Club is just appalling name for a band, although they are extremely successful. And,
are they?
Yes. So it's a very, very hip at the moment, Two Door Cinema
Club. Two Door Cinema Club. I'll seek them out. They've passed me by, as so many do these days. So, Magnus Shaw, that'll be the Eagles, and indeed your Dandy Warhols, joining the extensive list on the Pretend iPod.
Yeah, and you never know. Two Door Cinema Club may find their way on there one day.
You never know.
But only if they change their name.
Yes.
Well, that was the second pick, Dandy Warhol's Bohemian Like You, which, as everybody knows, means it's time to put our woolly socks on and head off to bed or to work or to dinner or just stay sitting there staring at the wall. Entirely up to you. But it does mean it's the end of the podcast for this week. Thanks very much for your time and attention, Mr. Dackham.
Thank you, Magnus.
Away you go, sir. And, of course, anybody and everybody listening, we do express our deep felt gratitude to you, and we will be back to do it again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.
Shore Media Production.
From half-spoken shadows emerges a canvas. A kiss of light breaks to reveal a moment when all mirrors are redundant. Listen to the portrait of the dance of perfection, the Spandau Ballet.